Okay, good afternoon, everybody. One of the important things we do here is that each program has one or two designated hitters to present some of the ideas, intellectual ideas behind their program to all the participants. So this is not aimed at necessarily the experts in that program, but for everybody. So today we're fortunate to have Chris Green from Purdue, and he's going to tell us about snippets of FMOS, Red Bear, and Common Core Physics.
Thanks a lot. Okay, so I'm glad to have the opportunity to say a few things about my interests, which covers a lot of the interests of the few body systems community. I've tried to pick some topics that aren't just sort of interest to the main core of the few body group, but touch on some things like quantum Hall physics from different points of view than those of you who are not few body physicists are probably used to thinking about it. But there are some basic, maybe I'll say a few words about the basic style of what we're trying to do, most of us working in few body physics. For a long time we were working to be able to develop calculational capability to describe more and more complicated few body systems. As you know, the difficulty grows sort of like exponentially or a factorial as you add more and more particles, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 particle systems. And, at some point, quite a bit of success has been achieved there, of course, especially in AMO and nuclear physics. I would say that then a lot of the interest gradually moved on to predicting new sorts of phenomena as we came to grips with understanding more and more complexity. And now a third sort of phase is affecting a lot of us, is occupying a lot of our time, which is trying to figure out ways to control and manipulate few body systems to do what we want. And this has been a major theme in AMO physics especially. So these three bullets highlight what I kind of sketched to talk about. And what I thought I would do is start, first of all, by an introduction to sort of the toolkit that sort of covers all three of these areas and overlaps a lot of what I want to say. So this preliminary is what I call the adiabatic toolkit. And as one more preliminary, I should say there's this famous quote from Phil Anderson, right? More is different. Okay, everyone loves that in condensed matter physicists. Well, I think as a few body physicist, I say few is exceptional. So, but of course the linkage between these fields, few body and many body, is at the heart of what is really going on in a lot of fields today. So the adiabatic toolkit I'll talk about, often we're interested in few body physics with the time-independent Schrodinger equation for n particles. Okay, let's start there. So this I better move that here. And then we have a kinetic energy, we have a potential energy operator, all acting on a wave function, zero. I'm usually interested in the time-independent Schrodinger equation, although we do sometimes tackle time-dependent phenomena like intense laser fields and so on. And that's one of the areas of interest in our program as well. But I'm going to focus today on non-relativistic time-independent quantum mechanics. And this is a, let's call it a d-dimensional program. We have n particles, they might be in 1 or 2 or 3 dimensions. So let's say there are d dimensions. Then you can recast this in terms, always, you can always recast this in terms of a hyperradius, one scalar coordinate, and d minus 1 hyperangles. That's always possible. Let's call all of those collectively omega. They all have a finite range. And now, a key point that a lot of us are using, not everyone is using hyperspherical coordinates, but we've used this to solve quite a few different problems, is to rewrite this Schrodinger equation. The kinetic energy operator is always separable, not only in independent particle coordinates, but also in the hyperspherical coordinates. And at least when there's no potential. Potential, of course, will do interesting things. But now we can recast this Hamiltonian as a kinetic energy operator in the hyperradius. And the rest of the Hamiltonian, where usually, unless you have momentum-dependent potentials or something like that, if you have local potentials, the rest of the Hamiltonian are, this hyperradius is just a parameter. Okay, and the basic starting point is this first recasting and then diagonalizing this fixed R Hamiltonian, which gives energies as a function of this parameter, this coordinate, the scalar coordinate R. So that eigenvalue equation, I like to write this way, HR equals constant, acting on, say, the ith eigenfunction that depends parametrically on R, but is really solving in this compact angular hyperspace that has a discrete spectrum. And these energies that depend on a parameter look just like Born-Oppenheimer potential curves that we're used to in molecular physics. So this is our kind of starting point for a lot of problems. This can be, as you might imagine, already a pretty hard problem to solve this d minus 1 Schrodinger equation. And it might seem like you haven't gained a whole lot by doing that. But basically, what you can get is then expand, at least in principle, this defines a complete orthonormal set of eigenfunctions. You can expand the exact solution of the original equation as a linear combination of all of those with unknown radial functions. Plug that in and project out the hyperangles, and then you get different ordinary differential equations for these radial functions. And actually, well, there's often some power factored out to eliminate first derivative terms so that you can really use your one-dimensional intuition, how you think of particles moving and potentials. And all of that is often included in this potential then. So the form of the equations then that you get, ignoring H-bars and masses now for just give you the basic idea, you get, if I regard this F as a big column vector, then you get the second derivative, you get these diagonal potentials, this is a diagonal matrix minus the identity matrix times the energy times F of R. And everything on the left-hand side of this equation is diagonal, but then there is a non-diagonal matrix that has coupling and including a derivative operator acting on F of R. And this drives the transitions between potential curves. So these potentials look, you know, maybe like you're used to seeing. Some might look like that. Sometimes there's lots and lots of these coming in. They fragment where the system can fragment into subsystems. And you can use your intuition in other ways, like you're used to things like Landau-Zener avoided crossings. You can use semi-classical ideas to analyze these kind of situations.
So can you say, what is W?
W has things like the phi I d squared dr squared phi j. And it has a term like what we call the P matrix, Pij of R, which is the first derivative version of this, times d by dr. Yeah?
Another question. What are the necessary conditions on the potential B for this to work? It looks like you need to throw out long range things, for example.
No, we included the long range.
Oh, okay. So what are the conditions?
Well, I think it just needs to depend parametrically on R.
I mean, exact, right?
Yeah, but it's an interaction between two different particles of two different...
Yeah, this includes all those interactions.
Okay.
They're all in there, but it just has assumed they are a function of all these coordinates. Like I say, if you have a spin orbit or something, then you're going to have to treat those as in a separate way. If you have, or momentum-dependent terms, then you'll have to treat them a different way. But that's not too hard to do, basically. Then you would just leave that out and not diagonalize that in the initial phase, and then it would be an off-diagonal diabatic coupling.
But if you have, say, a system like atomic physics, right, where particles are very different mass, right, it does include some kind of change in the parameter.
Oh, yeah, I didn't define the hyperradius.
But in this sense, physically, you know, it's clear that it's a very different case, right? If there is hierarchy.
Well, everything depends on the masses, and that's one of the interesting things.
Yeah.
I didn't explicitly show how it depends on, but I should probably define the hyperradius. One way is simply as the sum over each mass times its distance from the center of mass.
Yeah.
You can put a kind of arbitrary mass scale here. And changing that only changes the radial scale. That's one simple way of defining the general hyperradius. And then everything separates for no interaction. And this scheme is in principle exact if you include to completion to where you truncate. If you go far enough, it should hopefully converge.
Assuming spherical symmetry or not?
No. This is often done with cold atoms in a magnetic field, for instance.
So you're going to symmetrize later?
The symmetrization you can either do at the point where you solve this equation, pre-symmetrization, or you can do post-symmetrization, sometimes with more particles, as Alejandro has stressed in his work, because of the symmetrization problem grows as a factorial kind of problem. It's sometimes better to post-symmetrize because it's just so hard. If I get to it later, I'll show an example, like where you have millions of configurations in the quantum Hall problem. Yeah.
So, Chris, you contrast with Born-Oppenheimer. In Born-Oppenheimer, you would focus on a particular I, right? So you would.
That's a good point. The Born-Oppenheimer approximation amounts to neglecting this right-hand side, and then. It's just you have a separate differential equation for each I, separate motion in a single potential curve.
Although you get, there are Berry phase terms often you can add.
I'll come to Berry phase in when I'm talking about that. This is a scalar theory and there's no Berry phase. If we have solved this with single valued wave functions, we never have to mention the word Berry phase. R is a scalar, it's not a vector. Okay, but I'll talk about vector adiabaticity later. In the usual Born-Oppenheimer, it's often phrased as a vector. Like you clamp the nuclei really in space and you solve for the electron motion, and then the vector of the nuclei moves around in space.
Here it's one number.
Right. I was just going to quickly show an alternative form of this equation, which I think starts to look a little bit like gauge potential.
But in this case, which here you mentioned, Born-Oppenheimer, then this hyperradius is not exactly used because you are separating out say, more coordinate of nuclei from coordinate of, say, I don't know, electron, right? So in this way, you're not using in this form, right? You're using somewhat different.
Yeah, in say, the three-atom context, usually these are just the nuclei, and you say those three nuclei are moving on an electronic potential surface. So it's not often one treats both the electrons and the nuclei in this way, but there are some papers that have done that. Just this alternative form is kind of interesting. You can look at this as this P matrix, this first derivative version of this thing I wrote down. This operator squared plus U of R, again, diagonal potential energy matrix minus the diagonal, the identity times E F of R. You can also write this equation this way, and this starts to look like a sort of a non-abelian kind of a gauge potential.
Isn't it P of R? Okay, you locked it in U of R, P of R squared.
The P of R squared, there's an identity, it turns out to be, give you this term.
Oh, I see.
So that physics is all in this form. But it does assume infinite completeness when you do P squared of R to get that identity. Okay, it's just a detail. Okay, so I thought, because one of the main themes of our program is Efimov physics, that I would start by talking how we apply this and what has come out of Efimov physics, just kind of briefly. I already did talk about this in a colloquium, I think in 2010 here. So it's on the web if you want to read more details about the three and four body problems. But there have been some interesting developments in the last few years about the Efimov problem. So the Efimov effect, just briefly, is one of our interests, what I call more generically Efimov universality. Efimov's 1970 paper, it has more than 400 citations. It's gotten kind of exponentially growing citations since the late 90s when the connection between Efimov physics and controllable scattering lengths in cold atom physics became available. And the first experimental observation was in 2006, and then the field really took off. So the idea of Efimov physics is when you solve for these potential curves, it turns out if you take a zero range interaction, the relevant potential curve is very simple, and it's an exactly separable problem if you have zero range interactions. And it looks like this is energy versus R, looks like minus S naught squared minus a quarter over twice a three body reduced mass times R squared. And this is for short range interactions, actually for zero range interactions. This is the potential everywhere. Now this is, as you all know who've read Landau-Lifshitz, for instance, this it has the fall to the center problem because the ground state energy in this potential goes to minus infinity. S naught is, as long as S naught is a real number here. And so it has infinitely deep bound states, and it also has infinitely many long-range bound states condensing just like in a Coulomb potential, except geometrically instead of like 1 over n squared, converging geometrically. So the basic energy level formula looks like a universal factor, e to the pi over s naught squared. Sorry, that should be negative. Each successive level scales by the same factor of binding compared to the preceding one. And it gives an energy level spectrum if you look in a 1 over the scattering length scale for the two bodies interacting. Here I'm just considering the simplest case of all three identical particles. Actually, Yeah, so this is like square root of the absolute value of the energy. Then the two-body energy near very large scattering lengths just looks like a straight line. And the Efimov spectrum condensing around this point where A is infinity has this infinite number of bound states. And it's also especially of interest, these points, call them A0, A1, A2, where these energy levels hit zero energy, because that's where they become resonances that show up in, say, a Bose condensate or a cold, ultra-cold quantum gas, because you see a resonant three-body losses there. So there's a huge signature of these Efimov states in cold atom physics. And once you could tune scattering lengths, which I think started with experimentally with the Ketterle experiment in 1998, you can now see these resonances and confirm all the experiments, really confirm that this basic theory is correct. Oh, and I should mention these ANs also have this Efimov scaling factor, this universal factor, which doesn't, you know, change as you change the, whether it's rubidium or sodium, whatever, right? An plus one will always equal An times e to the pi over s naught in the universal limit. And this number, e to the pi over s naught, comes into both the energies and the scattering length resonances, is 22.7 for the homonuclear case, three equal mass particles. Now, this problem about the origin is solved because this is cut off by short-range physics in any problem. Yeah?
So, yeah, that's why I'm kind of getting to that. So A0 must be the corresponds to the deepest state, but so it's some UV scale? It's 1 over some...
Yeah, it's basically set by short-range physics, yeah.
So is it literally 1 over van der Waals length, or...?
I'll show you what it is in just a second. Yeah, it's not exactly that, but it's related to the van der Waals length. So yeah, that was actually one of the developments I wanted to talk about, is that this A0, which is sometimes referred to as the three-body parameter that sets the first scale of that first Efimov state, it used to be thought to be sort of a random number. You know, we basically, based on this theory, we could not decide. And this was a common belief in the theory community, by myself as well as just about everyone I know, until experimentalists proved we were wrong. And at least for van der Waals forces, it is universal within that framework, within that class of two-body interactions.
Well, also, Chris, is U of R, that's a diagonal matrix?
Yeah. Yeah, those are the eigenvalues, yeah. Before I say that, I should just stress, though, that these states are extremely counterintuitive. If you just think these very short-range forces combined the system in one of these large Efimov states, say with n greater than zero, far away from the atom-atom interactions. And the atoms are spending almost all their time out here in regions where they feel no force whatsoever. It's like they just gain enough attraction each time they do scatter, but that's enough to bind the system at negative energy. But it's still kind of mind-boggling to me that you can have these states that might be 20,000 Bohr radii apart, the atoms, even though their force is absent, is zero, effectively beyond about 100 Bohr.
So in the original Efimov solution, how did he get around the problem with setting the E0? Did he just postulate that, well, the scaling holds, I have no clue what E0 is?
That's basically how, yeah, he did it.
But given that E0 never enters the original Hamiltonian, does that not pose conceptual problem?
Well, I think he realized that this model Hamiltonian does not apply really over all space, and there will always be short-range physics that determine that.
But in case, sorry, but in case you are not two particles, just one particle, when your energy is close, I mean, in one dimensional problem, when energy close to zero, you also, wave function could be much larger than potential, right? Even without having three particles. Right?
Sure, but in principle, you can expand that from a millimeter trap to a meter trap more easily than you could, you know, modify the short range physics. So. Yeah.
In the question you were addressing with this kind of cartoon, would you then talk something about like a particle-assisted collision, that you have a scattering between two particles and the third one is just assisting that collision, and the result is that you have this very weakly bound state, or would you formulate it in a different way?
I guess I don't think of it that way. I think of all three particles, especially as I'm closer and closer to unitarity, I think of all three particles as colliding on an equal footing, but only gaining this bit of tiny whiff of attraction each time they do scatter. Okay. Yeah?
Is it what kind of partial day you're considering right now?
Is this is all J equals zero I'm talking about. Yeah. Zero orbital angular momentum.
And in this case, you're restricting the solution to only three particles.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to mention one of the big developments in this field a few years ago that we learned from the experimentalists is that actually A naught is not some random number. It's almost always negative about 9.5 times the van der Waals length, okay, which is defined as 1/2 the fourth root of 2 mu c6 over h bar squared. That defines a length, and experiments on many different two-body resonances of cesium, and later it's been also seen extensively for other systems, they always are clustering around this value, this universal value. And this was, a big surprise. There is a variation maybe of the order of 15%, but they're all hitting right around there. And so several theorists, including my own group, tackled this, and we found that because of van der Waals forces, it modifies this, there is a universal repulsive barrier that sets that three-body parameter, and it's occurring at a hyperradius of this barrier at around twice this van der Waals radius. And that ends up setting this scale. So that's the answer to your question. So the nuclear physicists aren't real happy if we say that now this is the universality because the nuclei aren't controlled by van der Waals forces. So a slightly better term might be van der Waals universality for systems that are controlled at long range by van der Waals interactions.
So going back to my question, so everything comes from the 1 over r squared potential. So you have four particles, can you also have 1 over r to the alpha? So is there any connection between the square having three particles?
Yeah, there is a proof that for equal mass particles, there is no true Efimov effect. Okay, but there is, the way we usually talk in this community is that there is few body physics connected with the Efimov effect. Okay, so if you think that the three body, this 1 over r squared potential, has some energy levels, right? Now, when we've solved the four body problem, and actually this was the topic of my colloquium, it's KITP colloquium in 2010. When you solve the four body problem, you will get a potential curve that there has to be one going to every one of these three body potentials. Three-body energy levels. It has to fragment, basically, into an Efimov trimer plus an atom. Okay. Every one of these Efimov states serves as a fragmentation threshold for the four-body system. But none of these have this 1 over r squared potential, although maybe in a sense there is kind of a diabatic 1 over r squared like that. Let's see, what did I want to say next? Yeah, so that was one of the big developments in Efimov physics. Another direction is to look at N boson clusters and see because it was found that for every two Efimov states, like this one and this one, this four-body study others as well as us found, there are always actually two four-body states between each threshold. One is just barely bound, and one is very, very close to the trimer energy when you're at infinite scattering length. Okay, and you can see four-body experiments have seen four-body recombination resonances and confirmed this kind of four-body universality, which at the time was thought there's still one unknown, the three-body parameter. But now basically we think the three-body parameter is largely set in this regime of large scattering lengths. And so the four-body scale is also set to a good approximation for van der Waals forces. But again, shouldn't expect that for nuclear forces.
I missed what, you know, so you have n eigenvalues, or d minus one eigenvalues for u. UI eigenvalues. So,
no,
so
UI of R, it has an infinite number. It's got right. An infinite spectrum of potentials. Or are you talking about the energy levels within the potential?
No, sorry, I was talking about UI. So what I'm wondering is, where's that? So they all go as 1 over R squared? Is that the
No, point? Well, okay, in the zero range case, that's true. If you really had zero range two-body interactions, there's only one attractive and a whole infinity of repulsive ones that represent the three-body continuum. I haven't been talking about those because they have no bound state physics, although they can be important for three-body.
There's one that has a bound state.
Yeah, just the one potential. It has the Efimov states in it.
So is that generic? Like that only one is attractive? One has a minimum? Or is there one but maybe a finite energy?
Well, it's generic for all three equal mass systems, I would say. But if you have two heavy and one light, you can get more than one branch that's attractive.
But in case of nuclear physics, they also have certain, you know, kind of understanding of short-range potential, right? So some kind of universal behavior.
I didn't mean to say that this is irrelevant. In fact, Efimov's first case was the triton, right? Two neutrons and a proton.
Yeah.
He claims is the kind of poster child for an Efimov state.
Yeah.
But since you can't control the nuclear physics, it's just kind of like attaching a name to a known phenomenon. It's really only when you can sweep the scattering length with the magnetic field that you can now really see the systematic evolution of all this physics at large scattering length. It's also of interest, for instance, Alejandro Kievsky and Dorota Bloom have done the N boson case, where if I just focus, for instance, on the lowest energy of the Efimov, say the A naught, the E naught, the lowest Efimov state for three bodies, then there will be a four body state, which is largely universal, at least for van der Waals forces, and a five body. This is again the one over scattering length. And so you can kind of think, as you're increasing the attraction, as you're going in this direction on the scattering length scale, you're making the system more and more attractive, that there is a place where five bosons are bound, but nothing smaller. You've got so many attractions in the system, in all the pairwise interactions for the five bosons that they bind, but it's still not quite enough to bind four or three. Okay, so these seem to be largely universal, although the field is still really mapping out the extent to which it's universal, and it's a pretty active area. But these numbers, like the ratio between this five-body energy and this four-body energy, are pretty well understood now. And there has actually been a five-body resonance seen by Rudy Grimm's group, and we were doing some of the theory on it. Still kind of blows my mind. There is a place or a regime of densities in the gas and scattering lengths where all five atoms colliding to make, you know, various fragments like maybe A3 plus A2 or A4 plus A, where this is the dominant way atoms are lost from the gas. It seems like such an improbable physical process. But when you hit this resonance, it can dominate for a range of densities. It still kind of blows my mind.
Right, but in this form, it is five-particle collision. You're kind of reducing it to two particles, right? A3 and A2, right? Effectively. So in this way, it becomes much more probable, right? If you believe that it would be kind of, imagine that the three particle take one particle, and another two is also one.
No. It's not sequential like that. It's really five colliding simultaneously.
No, I understand. Yeah, no, but I mean, because of this correlation inside of three particle, I mean, you can try to imagine that it is like complex of three particle colliding with a complex of two particles.
I'm not real sure how useful that is, but one could try to tackle it that way.
So let's say there's a five, you're near the five cluster instability resonance.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's already more attractive than where the six cluster and seven cluster and all the higher cluster instability.
That's right, but you're not near a resonance in those, and those require an even higher density to get six atoms together simultaneously. So it's true, you could also presumably go to this point, and at some point this probably terminates when the binding energy and the clusters are getting so tight now, the short-range forces are beginning to come in. But for something like helium clusters, this is not a crazy picture, except for the fact that the scattering length in helium is not negative.
But is it the way is it manifestation of just bosons with attraction are just fundamentally unstable? Or is it, that you just want to clump into?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, I am assuming attractive interactions that can give a negative scattering length. There's a spectrum here. There's a quantization. I mean, if you sit here, you don't see that effect. It's not just kind of, everything's attracted and wants to clump. It's true, if you're in sort of thermodynamic equilibrium, this state at zero energy, like in a BEC, is not in dynamic equilibrium. There are all these lower states that are not occupied. Some other directions in Efimov physics that are of interest, but maybe I'll skip, is there's recent work on the heavy light system, like two cesium atoms and one lithium, where this Efimov scaling changes from 22.7 into like 4.9. And so because this 22.7 is so unfavorable to see multiple resonances, the 4.9 is much better. And the group at Chicago and the group at Heidelberg have both been able to see like a series of three Efimov resonances separated to experimental accuracy by about this factor. So that was a goal a long time for the field, to see this more favorable Efimov scenario for heavy light systems. And now that's been realized in the past couple of years. I think maybe I should skip on to the Rydberg part of the talk. What are we doing?
Can I just ask a very quick question before you do that? If you're interested in the positive scattering length regime, so you have some instability down to the Efimov states present, what kind of time scale do you get if you want to investigate universality near A0 on the positive side before you get these decays? In other words, if you want to look at the upper bunch.
Do you mean like what is the lifetime against three-body decay in gas?
I mean, there's an upper branch not shown here on the A is...
Oh, for A greater than zero?
Yeah, exactly. But that can also decay, right?
Yeah, there are no resonances here, at least in the homonuclear case.
There are none? It looks like in the diagram there are.
Oh, okay. So at these energies down here there are, where you would have like an atom-dimer collision.
Yeah.
And you can have that. But if you have a bunch of atoms in a BEC, then there are no dimers present. And you don't expect to see resonant atom-dimer collision because there are no dimers.
It sounds like you're saying it's infinity somehow.
Well, there has actually been some experimental signatures here, and they aren't very well understood theoretically yet. Okay, enough Efimov. One of the interesting things, actually I had two things to Rydberg I wanted to talk about, which is becoming increasingly clear. My time frame is unrealistic, but that's fine. One of them is that if you take like a rubidium atom, kick an electron up to a high principal quantum number state, okay, that's your classic Rydberg state. And now if there's another ground state rubidium atom nearby, then you can break this down also into a sum of basically two-body interactions. This one is very weak directly between the ion and the rubidium atom ground state. But the electron ground state rubidium can be rather strong. And of course, this ion grabs that electron and keeps it in its Rydberg orbit. So one of the interesting things that comes out when you solve this problem is that when you try to put in the electron-rubidium interaction into this problem, you can do it with a generalization of the Fermi pseudopotential, right? The Fermi pseudopotential you're all used to is you have an S-wave scattering length and basically a zero-range interaction between the electron and the perturbing ground state atom. But an interesting that happens in all the alkalis is that there is a low energy resonance between an electron and rubidium. And there is a generalization to P waves that has, I'll call it the P wave scattering volume. Actually, let me just write it in terms of phase shifts. The P wave scattering phase shift a funny gradient operator that has a gradient acting to the left, a delta function, and a gradient operator acting to the right. Omanta came up with this generalization. And because this phase shift depends on energy, and the energy depends on at what R value the rubidium atom is when it collides. Like if it's in here, the electron is going much faster for a given total energy because it has more Coulomb potential energy it can convert into the energy of its collision. So the phase shift of that P wave, right, it has a resonance where it rises by about pi radians at around, I don't know, 10, 20 milliEV, something like that. And that shows up in the Born-Oppenheimer potential curves. This rise of the phase shift ends up in the potential energy curves. Like if I look at the potential curve going to an n equals 30 Rydberg state, this goes down by exactly one cycle, just corresponding to the fact that this phase shift is adding one node to the wave function. As you come in, the energy of the Rydberg state the energy of the electron colliding with the Rydberg state traces out this resonance, and you see a potential curve that looks something like that. And when you put in more details, it doesn't look exactly like that. It ends up looking something like that. It has all the nodal structure of the Rydberg electron wave function. And actually, you can bind states in these wells, and they look kind of like a butterfly, and we've called these butterfly Rydberg molecules. These were just seen experimentally. We had a Nature Communications article 6 weeks ago, which seems to be very popular. It's gotten like 4,000 page downloads on Nature Communications. So we're very happy about these butterfly Rydberg molecules, but they're kind of silly. Right? Just every time the electron collides, you get this extra phase from this resonant interaction, and you can make these states that have an electronic wave function that look kind of like a butterfly. So that's kind of fun.
Can you say, why is that n equal to 1? Why is not n equal to 0? So why, is there any simple way to see that is the P wave that is?
Oh, the P wave, well, I mean, of course, the electron atom potential, it has a 1 over r fourth attraction. And for P wave, the effective potential when I add the centrifugal barrier, For many atoms, there's a low-energy P-wave shape resonance. You go to D-wave, and it's just pretty much all repulsive. It's just not strong enough to make a D or F or G-wave resonance. Maybe in some atoms it is, but at least in the alkalis, there's only a P-wave resonance. Okay, I just wanted to say that short advertisement for the butterfly Rydberg molecules, and it's kind of cool. These were predicted in 2002 and only seen this past year experimentally. And they have huge dipole moments, which I think could lead to some interesting many-body physics, because you can get dipole moments up in the almost kilodibye sort of range, which is kind of weird if you realize it's just a diatomic molecule about the size of a virus. So let me come to this topic about non-abelian gauge fields, which I think might interest some of you here. And now I'm telling you about something that's not really a new topic for me, and it's one of my least cited pieces of work in my entire career. But with all the interest these days in non-abelian gauge fields, and especially in condensed matter physics and in high energy physics, I think it's time to think about the realizations that occur in some very, very simple atomic spectra problems. So my interest in this was triggered some years after I saw a paper by Bernard Ziegelman, who wrote a PRL in about 1990, considering an electron in the field of an open shell ion, atomic ion. Okay? So basically you take an ion core, positively charged, you give it some angular momentum. I'll probably be considering just like one unit of angular momentum for simplicity. And you consider a Rydberg electron in the field of that. Of course, a Rydberg electron is moving very slow compared to any other degree of freedom. So it's very natural to consider a sort of an adiabatic kind of treatment of this Rydberg electron motion. And so if we say the ion has an angular momentum vector L. Of course, in the quantum mechanical sense, L squared is quantized, and LZ is quantized. And the Rydberg electron has an orbital angular momentum L, again, in the quantum mechanical sense. Then Ziegelman's prediction was that there should be, on topological arguments, along the lines of Wilczek and Z's famous paper in 1984, and Jakiev had some work in, I think, 86, based on these kind of ideas, and Berry phase predicted there should be a term that looks like a constant times a dot product of the core angular momentum vector with the electron angular momentum vector divided by r to the sixth. Now, when I first saw this, I had a very hard time understanding it. I thought, okay, well, it looks kind of like spin-orbit interaction. But actually, this neglects all magnetic interactions in the problem. This is an entirely electrostatic plus kinetics and angular momentum term. It does not have a 1 over c squared or something like that that you'd expect for a magnetic, a real spin-orbit or orbit-orbit interaction. And so I got interested when I heard Steve Lundeen, an experimentalist who measures in very precise spectroscopy the very high Rydberg states. He measures things that would be sensitive to terms like that.
But it is still spin-orbit, right? By definition, by your definition, in a sense that it is spin-off of...
I don't want to call it that, because that we always think of as a magnetic interaction.
No, I understand, but in terms of physics,
But there's also no one over R6 spin orbit
interaction. But in terms of definition of what interacts with what, it is still spin in orbit.
You can call it that. It's a free country.
For a while.
Or it used to be. one thing Siegelman could not do was actually calculate this coefficient. He said, well, it's of the order of an atomic polarizability. Those are usually sort of small atoms of the order of 5 atomic units, Bohr radii cubed, you know, to maybe 50. It would normally be something in that range. And that was one reason Steve Lundeen approached me and said, well, you know, can you show how this comes out of solving the Schrodinger equation? Does such a term really exist? It's argued to be there on topological grounds, but without a quantitative theory behind it that really gives the numbers that an experimentalist needs. So, I should maybe mention one more historic, I'm almost out of time, one more historical point, which is that in the 50s, a couple of pretty well-known spectroscopists, like Rocca and Trees, they postulated on the basis of discrepancies in atomic spectra that a term of that structure had to be in the Hamiltonian somehow. But again, they did not have a theory of from first principles. So let me kind of give a really quick version of how we did find there is an interaction term like that. Just kind of doing meat and potatoes quantum mechanics, and without doing this vector adiabatic theory, where you really are tracing adiabatically the Rydberg electron through space as a vector, which is the Siegelman kind of point of view, where then you have to introduce Berry's phase and to make it a single-valued wave function and all that good stuff. So we did it with a scalar adiabatic theory. And so we only treat the magnitude of R adiabatically and just solve the Schrodinger equation with single-valued wave functions everywhere. And what we found is that in second-order perturbation theory, I'll put, by the way, all these notes on the website if any of you are interested in more of these details I don't have time to cover. But when you diagonalize the Hamiltonian at fixed values of the radius r, you get in second-order perturbation theory terms like the dipole interaction of the dipole operator between the electron and the core. R core means like the electrons in the core, with the angle of the Rydberg electron. And then, of course, you have a sum over an infinite set of intermediate states. And then, again, the same kind of an operator. And but then divided, not just by the difference of energies of the atom, the way you usually think you when you do perturbation theory over the whole space. Now, because we're doing perturbation theory at fixed R, we have the centrifugal energy coming in as well. This is coming in the denominator when you do perturbation theory at a fixed R value. And I think you can see roughly what's going to happen when you do a binomial expansion at large R of those centrifugal terms. They'll come up into the numerator.
But you have fixed R, and what is Re? What is the meaning of?
Which R are you?
This one. Yeah,
this one?
No, next one.
Yes. This is the core electrons of the ion. So we did like a partial wave expansion of 1 over Rij. And okay, so when you bring that into the numerator, you get things like the difference of these centrifugal energies and a term with the energy denominator squared. And some stuff here I don't have time to write. But the bottom line is, one can then just do a simple angular momentum recoupling, recouple this product of two scalars into a cross product, like of this R core and this R core prime from this other matrix element, there will be terms in that recoupling that look like this, where you now have something that you can replace by the Wigner-Eckardt theorem, you can replace by the L of the core and the L of the Rydberg electron. And so we could give a quantitative expression for all this, and it was observed basically in agreement with Steve Lundy's experiments.
So, Chris, how different is from a quantum defect? So is there, when you include the Young, so there is quantum defect corrections in your Rydberg, how different is this correction to quantum?
Well, all the quantum defects, I guess this is, in a sense, it's calculating those quantum defects in this second-order perturbation.
But it should be something like R multiplied by R dot, right? Rather than R multiplied by R, right? Because R multiplied by R would, if it's a cross product, it would be just zero, right? So
these are different R's because they're in different matrix.
No, where RCR, different RCRC prime. Right, but effectively what you call momentum, it clearly involves some movement, right? So some velocity, because when you're using the substituting this by L.
There will be a compensating ratio of reduced matrix elements.
Yeah.
But the operator does have this form, exactly that Ziegelman hypothesized. And we have a formula for beta.
Right, but my impression is that it's something like multiplying and divided by velocity, because L does contain velocity.
Yeah, if you like.
Right, and originally it was none, right? So either it depends on some velocities, or you are doing some procedure which involves...
Well, there's energies.
It's sitting there, right?
That's where that information is, and in the ratio of reduced matrix elements. But anyway, that's the main thing is, I think it's useful, the fact, maybe just conclude on this point, I think it's useful to examine more this connection between vector adiabatic theories, where you have Barry's phase and all of this, and non-abelian gauges, and scalar adiabatic theories, where that does not arise, which sometimes, like in this case, is actually an easier way to do computations. Whether that carries over to many body contexts, I don't know. But... anyway, I've taken an hour of your time, so I think I'll stop
it
there.
It could be that in certain sense you are introducing something instead of C square. If it would be magnetic, you would say that it would be 1 over C square, right? Here, instead of C square, you have some kind of effective velocity in the denominator, and in this sense, it's magnetic interaction.
It's not magnetic.
No, I mean...
I disagree completely.
No.
Electrostatics
if you are dividing by the square...
Non-relativistic
magnetic in the sense that if I will interpret denominator as containing some velocity square, then I would make an analogy with what magnetic interaction. I agree that it's not magnetic interaction. I'm not arguing this.
I might also say that Ziegelman, says you can call all of this theory... what does he call it? A magnetic, where did I write that? A Tuhuft Polyakov monopole. So anyway, I guess, I certainly didn't think at the time of writing to Nature and saying this beautiful theory is proof that magnetic monopoles exist, but maybe I'll do that one day. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Magnetic thing. I mean, just simply the fact that when we say that we're coupling two angular momenta, it's a formal way to say we couple two angular momenta, but it corresponds to some kind of interaction.
Sure, there's an interaction.
Just the fact that you have charge which are moving, generating a field which are deep.
That's not the only type of interaction. Coulomb interaction does not involve. This is all Coulomb interaction. It's not velocity induced. Okay. The only way velocity comes in is through these things. Okay.
Yep. So formally, so when you invoke the Wigner-Eckert theorem, formally L is R cross P, right? Or if you will, R cross R dot.
Sure.
It's the same question, where did R dot go? There should be some time difference.
Yeah, that comes into a reduced matrix element that you can evaluate with standard angular momentum algebra.
But so let's say you wanted to calculate spin-orbit coupling in a regular sense, right? The way we teach it usually in quantum mechanics, we say, okay, well, you know, an atom sits in an effective magnetic field. It's like magnetic energy of a magnetic monopole. Mm-hmm. Right? Whereas the current is being generated, let's say, by Biot-Savart law, mm-hmm. by an electron moving around. Can I not use the same argument and say here that I have L core sitting there, and I have an electron moving around, and I generate some effective LC dot L?
I don't think it's anything induced, because then there would be a 1 over the speed of light. There is no C coming into this. Speed of light does not enter this calculation. There would be a V over C if it was really magnetic.